This is Audible.
The Harper Audio session you are about to hear is The World Without Us, written by Alan Wiseman, narrated by Adam Grupper, published by HarperCollins Publishers Limited.
The firmament is blue forever, and the earth will long stand firm and bloom in spring. But man, how long will you live? Lee Tai Po, Hans Bethge, Gustav Mahler, The Chinese Flute, Drinking Song of the Sorrow of the Earth, Das Lied von der Erde. The World Without Us. Prelude, A Monkey Cone. One June morning in 2004, Anna Maria Santi sat against a post beneath a large palm-thatched canopy, frowning as she watched a gathering of her people in Mazarica, their hamlet on the Rio Conambu, an Ecuadorian tributary of the upper Amazon. Except for Anna Maria's hair, still thick and black after 7 decades, everything about her recalled a dried legume pod. Her gray eyes resembled 2 pale fish trapped in the dark eddies of her face. In a patois of Quichua and a nearly vanished language, Zapara, she scolded her nieces and granddaughters. An hour past dawn, they and everyone in the village, except Anna Maria, were already drunk. The occasion was a minga, the Amazonian equivalent of a barn raising. 40 barefoot Zapara Indians, several in face paint, sat jammed in a circle on log benches. To prime the men for going out to slash and burn the forest to clear a new cassava patch for Anna Maria's brother, they were drinking chicha, gallons of it. Even the children slurped ceramic bowls full of the milky, sour beer, brewed from cassava pulp, fermented with the saliva of Zapara women who chew wads of it all day. 2 girls with grass braided in their hair passed among the throng, refilling chicha bowls and serving dishes of catfish gruel. To the elders and guests, they offered hunks of boiled meat, dark as chocolate. But Anna Maria Santi, the oldest person present, wasn't having any. Although the rest of the human race was already hurtling into a new millennium, the Zapara had barely entered the Stone Age. Like the spider monkeys, from whom they believed themselves descended, the Zapara essentially still inhabit trees, lashing palm trunks together with bejuco vines to support roofs woven of palm fronds. Until cassava arrived, palm hearts were their main vegetable. For protein, they netted fish and hunted tapirs, peccaries, wood quail, and curassows with bamboo darts and blowguns. They still do, but there is little game left. When Anna Maria's grandparents were young, she says, the forest easily fed them, even though the Zapara were then one of the largest tribes of the Amazon, with some 200,000 members living in villages along all the neighboring rivers. Then something happened far away, and nothing in their world, or anybody's, was ever the same. What happened was that Henry Ford figured out how to mass-produce automobiles. The demand for inflatable tubes and tires soon found ambitious Europeans heading up every navigable Amazonian stream, claiming land with rubber trees, and seizing laborers to tap them. In Ecuador, they were aided by highland Quichua Indians, evangelized earlier by Spanish missionaries, and happy to help chain the heathen lowland Zapara men to trees and work them until they fell. Zapara women and girls taken as breeders or sex slaves were raped to death. By the 1920s, rubber plantations in Southeast Asia had undermined the market for wild South American latex. The few hundred Zapara who had managed to hide during the rubber genocide stayed hidden. Some posed as Quichua, living among the enemies who now occupied their lands. Others escaped into Peru. Ecuador's Zapara were officially considered extinct. Then, in 1999, after Peru and Ecuador resolved a long border dispute, a Peruvian Zapara shaman was found walking in the Ecuadorian jungle. He had come, he said, to finally meet his relatives. The rediscovered Ecuadorian Zapara became an anthropological cause célèbre. The government recognized their territorial rights, albeit to only a shred of their ancestral land, and UNESCO bestowed a grant to revive their culture and save their language. By then, only 4 members of the tribe still spoke it, Anna Maria Santi among them. The forest they once knew was mostly gone. From the occupying Quechua, they had learned to fell trees with steel machetes and burn the stumps to plant cassava. After a single harvest, each plot had to be fallowed for years. In every direction, the towering forest canopy had been replaced by spindly second-growth shoots of laurel, magnolia, and copa palm. Cassava was now their mainstay, consumed all day in the form of chicha. The zapara had survived into the 21st century, but they had entered it tipsy and stayed that way. They still hunted, but men now walked for days without finding tapirs or even quail. They had resorted to shooting spider monkeys, whose flesh was formerly taboo. Again, Anna Maria pushed away the bowl proffered by her granddaughters, which contained chocolate-colored meat with a tiny thumbless paw jutting over its side. She raised her knotted chin toward the rejected boiled monkey. "When we're down to eating our ancestors," she asked, "what is left?" So far from the forests and savannas of our origins, few of us still sense a link to our animal forebears. That the Amazonian zapara actually do is remarkable, since the divergence of humans from other primates occurred on another continent. Nevertheless, lately we have had a creeping sense of what Anna Maria means. Even if we're not driven to cannibalism, might we too face terrible choices as we skulk toward the future? A generation ago, humans eluded nuclear annihilation. With luck, we'll continue to dodge that and other mass terrors. But now we often find ourselves asking whether inadvertently we've poisoned or parboiled the planet, ourselves included. We've also used and abused water and soil so that there's a lot less of each, and trampled thousands of species that probably aren't coming back. Our world, some respected voices warn, could one day degenerate into something resembling a vacant lot, where crows and rats scuttle among weeds, preying on each other. If it comes to that, at what point would things have gone so far that, for all our vaunted superior intelligence, we're not among the hardy survivors? The truth is, we don't know. Any conjecture gets muddled by our obstinate reluctance to accept that the worst might actually occur. We may be undermined by our survival instincts, honed over eons to help us deny, defy, or ignore catastrophic portents, lest they paralyze us with fright. If those instincts dupe us into waiting until it's too late, that's bad. If they fortify our resistance in the face of mounting omens, that's good. More than once, crazy, stubborn hope has inspired creative strokes that snatched people from ruin. So let us try a creative experiment. Suppose that the worst has happened. Human extinction is a fait accompli, not by nuclear calamity, asteroid collision, or anything ruinous enough to also wipe out most everything else, leaving whatever remained in some radically altered, reduced state, nor by some grim echo scenario in which we agonizingly fade, dragging many more species with us in the process. Instead, picture a world from which we all suddenly vanished. Tomorrow. Unlikely, perhaps, but for the sake of argument, not impossible. Say a Homo sapiens-specific virus, natural or diabolically nano-engineered, picks us off but leaves everything else intact. Or some misanthropic evil wizard somehow targets that unique 3.9% of DNA that makes us human beings and not chimpanzees. Or perfects a way to sterilize our sperm. Or say that Jesus, more on him later, or space aliens rapture us away, either to our heavenly glory or to a zoo somewhere across the galaxy. Look around you at today's world, your house, your city, the surrounding land, the pavement underneath, and the soil hidden below that. Leave it all in place, but extract the human beings. Wipe us out, and see what's left. How would the rest of nature respond if it were suddenly relieved of the relentless pressures we heap on it and our fellow organisms? How soon would, or could, the climate return to where it was before we fired up all our engines? How long would it take to recover lost ground and restore Eden to the way it must have gleamed and smelled the day before Adam, or Homo habilis, appeared? Could nature ever obliterate all our traces? How would it undo our monumental cities and public works, and reduce our myriad plastics and toxic synthetics back to benign basic elements? Or are some so unnatural that they're indestructible? And what of our finest creations, our architecture, our art, our many manifestations of spirit? Are any truly timeless? At least enough so to last until the sun expands and roasts our earth to a cinder? And even after that, might we have left some faint enduring mark on the universe, some lasting glow or echo of earthly humanity, some interplanetary sign that once we were here? For a sense of how the world would go on without us, among other places, we must look to the world before us. We're not time travelers, and the fossil record is only a fragmentary sampling. But even if that record were complete, the future won't perfectly mirror the past. We've ground some species so thoroughly into extinction that they or their DNA will likely never spring back. Since some things we've done are likely irrevocable, what would remain in our absence would not be the same planet had we never evolved in the first place. Yet it might not be so different either. Nature has been through worse losses before, and refilled empty niches. And even today, there are still a few earthly spots where all our senses can inhale a living memory of this Eden before we were here. Inevitably, they invite us to wonder how nature might flourish, if granted the chance. Since we're imagining, why not also dream of a way for nature to prosper that doesn't depend on our demise? We are, after all, mammals ourselves. Every life form adds to this vast pageant. With our passing, might some lost contribution of ours leave the planet a bit more impoverished? Is it possible that, instead of heaving a huge biological sigh of relief, the world without us would miss us? Part 1. Chapter 1. A Lingering Scent of Eden. You may never have heard of the Białowieska Puszcza, but if you were raised somewhere in the temperate swath that crosses much of North America, Japan, Korea, Russia, several former Soviet republics, part of China, Turkey, and Eastern and Western Europe, including the British Isles, something within you remembers it. If instead you were born to tundra or desert, subtropics or tropics, pampas or savannas, there are still places on earth kindred to this Puszcza to stir your memory too. Puszcza, an old Polish word, means forest primeval. Straddling the border between Poland and Belarus, the 500,000 acres of the Białowieska Puszcza contain Europe's last remaining fragment of old-growth lowland wilderness. Think of the misty, brooding forest that loomed behind your eyelids when, as a child, someone read you the Grimm Brothers fairy tales. Here, ash and linden trees tower nearly 150 feet, their huge canopies shading a moist, tangled understory of hornbeams, ferns, swamp alders, and crockery-sized fungi. Oaks, shrouded with half a millennium of moss, grow so immense here that great spotted woodpeckers store spruce cones in their 3-inch-deep bark furrows. The air, thick and cool, is draped with silence that parts briefly for a nutcracker's croak, a pygmy owl's low whistle, or a wolf's wail, then returns to stillness. The fragrance that wafts from eons of accumulated mulch in the forest's core harkens to fertility's very origins. In the Białowieska, the profusion of life owes much to all that is dead. Almost a quarter of the organic mass above ground is in assorted stages of decay, More than 50 cubic yards of decomposing trunks and fallen branches on every acre, nourishing thousands of species of mushrooms, lichens, bark beetles, grubs, and microbes that are missing from the orderly managed woodlands that pass as forests elsewhere. Together, those species stock a sylvan larder that provides for weasels, pine martens, raccoons, badgers, otters, fox, lynx, wolves, roe deer, elk, and eagles. More kinds of life are found here than anywhere else on the continent. Yet there are no surrounding mountains or sheltering valleys to form unique niches for endemic species. The Byamovieska Pushcha is simply a relic of what once stretched east to Siberia and west to Ireland. The existence in Europe of such a legacy of unbroken biological antiquity owes, unsurprisingly, to high privilege. During the 14th century, a Lithuanian duke named Vladislaw Jagiello, having successfully allied his Grand Duchy with the Kingdom of Poland, declared the forest a royal hunting preserve. For centuries, it stayed that way. When the Polish-Lithuanian Union was finally subsumed by Russia, the Białowieża became the private domain of the Tsars. Although occupying Germans took lumber and slaughtered game during World War I, a pristine core was left intact, which in 1921 became a Polish national park. The timber pillaging resumed briefly under the Soviets, but when the Nazis invaded, a nature fanatic named Hermann Göring decreed the entire preserve off-limits, except by his pleasure. Following World War II, a reportedly drunken Joseph Stalin agreed one evening in Warsaw to let Poland retain 2/5 of the forest. Little else changed under communist rule, except for construction of some elite hunting dachas, in one of which, Vesculi, an agreement was signed in 1991, dissolving the Soviet Union into free states. Yet, as it turns out, this ancient sanctuary is more threatened under Polish democracy and Belarusian independence than it was during 7 centuries of monarchs and dictators. Forestry ministries in both countries tout increased management to preserve the Pushcha's health. Management, however, often turns out to be a euphemism for culling and selling mature hardwoods that otherwise would one day return a windfall of nutrients to the forest. It is startling to think that all Europe once looked like this Pushcha. To enter it is to realize that most of us were bred to a pale copy of what nature intended. Seeing elders with trunks 7 feet wide, or walking through stands of the tallest trees here, gigantic Norway spruce, shaggy as Methuselah, should seem as exotic as the Amazon or Antarctica to someone raised among the comparatively puny second-growth woodlands found throughout the Northern Hemisphere. Instead, what's astonishing is how primally familiar it feels, and on some cellular level, how complete. Andrzej Bobiek recognized it instantly. As a forestry student in Krakow, he'd been trained to manage forests for maximum productivity, which included removing excess organic litter, lest it harbor pests like bark beetles. Then, on a visit here, he was stunned to discover 10 times more biodiversity than in any forest he'd ever seen. It was the only place left with all 9 European woodpecker species, because, he realized, some of them only nest in hollow, dying trees. They can't survive in managed forests, he argued to his forestry professors. The Białowieska Pushcha has managed itself perfectly well for millennia. The husky, bearded young Polish forester became instead a forest ecologist. He was hired by the Polish National Park Service. Eventually, he was fired for protesting management plans that chipped ever closer to the pristine core of the Pushcha. In various international journals, he blistered official policies that asserted that forests will die without our thoughtful help, or that justified cutting timber in the Białowieska's surrounding buffer to re-establish the primeval character of stands. Such convoluted thinking, he accused, was rampant among Europeans who have hardly any memory of forested wilderness. to keep his own memory connected. For years he daily laced his leather boots and hiked through his beloved Pushcha. Yet although he ferociously defends those parts of this forest still undisturbed by man, Andrei Bobiek can't help being seduced by his own human nature. Alone in the woods, Bobiek enters into communion with fellow Homo sapiens through the ages. A wilderness this pure is a blank slate to record human passage, a record he has learned to read. Charcoal layers in the soil show him where gamesmen once used fire to clear parts of the forest for browse. Stands of birch and trembling aspen attest to a time when Jagello's descendants were distracted from hunting, perhaps by war, long enough for these sun-seeking species to recolonize game clearings. In their shade grow telltale seedlings of the hardwoods that were here before them. Gradually, these will crowd out the birch and aspen, until it will be as if they were never gone. Whenever Bobiek happens on an anomalous shrub like hawthorn, or on an old apple tree, he knows he's in the presence of the ghost of a log house long ago devoured by the same microbes that can turn the giant trees here back into soil. Any lone massive oak he finds growing from a low clover-covered mound marks a crematorium. Its roots have drawn nourishment from the ashes of Slavic ancestors of today's Belarusians who came from the east 900 years ago. On the northwest edge of the forest, Jews from five surrounding shtetls buried their dead. Their sandstone and granite headstones from the 1850s, mossy and tumbled by roots, have already worn so smooth that they've begun to resemble the pebbles left by their mourning relatives, who themselves long ago departed. Andrei Bobiek passes through a blue-green glade of Scots pine, barely a mile from the Belarusian border. The waning October afternoon is so hushed, he can hear snowflakes alight. Suddenly, there's a crashing in the underbrush, and a dozen visent, bison bonasus, European bison, burst from where they've been browsing on young shoots. Steaming and pawing, their huge black eyes glance just long enough for them to do what their own ancestors discovered they must upon encountering one of these deceptively frail bipeds. They flee. Just 600 visent remain in the wild, nearly all of them here, or just half, depending on what's meant by here. An iron curtain bisects this paradise, erected by the Soviets in 1980 along the border to thwart escapees to Poland's renegade solidarity movement. Although wolves dig under it, and roe deer and elk are believed to leap it, the herd of these largest of Europe's mammals remains divided, and with it, its gene pool. Divided and mortally diminished, some zoologists fear. Once, following World War I, bison from zoos were brought here to replenish a species nearly extirpated by hungry soldiers. Now a remnant of a Cold War threatens them again. Belarus, which well after communism's collapse has yet to remove statues of Lenin, also shows no inclination to dismantle the fence, especially as Poland's border is now the European Union's. Although just 14 kilometers separate the two countries' park headquarters, to see the Belowieszkaya Puszcza, as it is called in Belarusian, a foreign visitor must drive 100 miles south, take a train across the border to the city of Brest, submit to pointless interrogation, and hire a car to drive back north. Andrei Bobiek's Belarusian counterpart and fellow activist, Hiorhi Kazulka, is a pale, sallow invertebrate biologist and former deputy director of Belarus's side of the primeval forest. He was also fired by his own country's park service for challenging one of the latest park additions, a sawmill. He cannot risk being seen with Westerners. Inside the Brezhnev-era tenement where he lives at the forest's edge, he apologetically offers visitors tea and discusses his dream of an international peace park where bison and moose would roam and breed freely. The Puszcza's colossal trees are the same as those in Poland, the same buttercups, lichens, and enormous red oak leaves, the same circling white-tailed eagles, heedless of the razor-wire barrier below. In fact, on both sides, the forest is actually growing, as peasant populations leave shrinking villages for cities. In this moist climate, birch and aspen quickly invade their fallow potato fields. Within just two decades, farmland gives way to woodland. Under the canopy of the pioneering trees, oak, maple, linden, elm, and spruce regenerate. Given 500 years without people, a true forest could return. The thought of rural Europe reverting one day to original forest is heartening. But unless the last humans remember to first remove Belarus's Iron Curtain, its bison may wither away with them. Chapter 2. Unbuilding Our Home. If you want to destroy a barn, a farmer once told me, cut an 18-inch square hole in the roof. Then stand back. Architect Chris Riddle, Amherst, Massachusetts. On the day after humans disappear, nature takes over and immediately begins cleaning house, or houses, that is. Cleans them right off the face of the earth. They all go. If you're a homeowner, you already knew it was only a matter of time for yours, but you've resisted admitting it, even as erosion callously attacked, starting with your savings. Back when they told you what your house would cost, nobody mentioned what you'd also be paying so that nature wouldn't repossess it long before the bank. Even if you live in a denatured postmodern subdivision where heavy machines mash the landscape into submission, replacing unruly native flora with obedient sod and uniform saplings, and paving wetlands in the righteous name of mosquito control, even then, you know that nature wasn't fazed. No matter how hermetically you've sealed your temperature-tuned interior from the weather, invisible spores penetrate anyway, exploding in sudden outbursts of mold. Awful when you see it, worse when you don't, because it's hidden behind a painted wall, munching paper sandwiches of gypsum board, rotting studs and floor joists. Or you've been colonized by termites, carpenter ants, roaches, hornets, even small mammals. Most of all, though, you are beset by what in other contexts is the veritable stuff of life, water. It always wants in. After we're gone, nature's revenge for our smug mechanized superiority arrives waterborne. It starts with wood frame construction, the most widely used residential building technique in the developed world. It begins on the roof, probably asphalt or slate shingle, warranted to last two or three decades. But that warranty doesn't count around the chimney, where the first leak occurs. As the flashing separates under rain's relentless insistence, water sneaks beneath the shingles. It flows across 4x8-foot sheets of sheathing, made either of plywood, or if newer, of wood chip board composed of 3 to 4 inch flakes of timber bonded together by a resin. Newer isn't necessarily better. Wernher von Braun, the German scientist who developed the U.S. space program, used to tell a story about Colonel John Glenn, the first American to orbit the Earth. Seconds before liftoff, with Glenn strapped into that rocket we built for him, and man's best efforts all focused on that moment, you know what he said to himself? "Oh my God, I'm sitting on a pile of low bids." In your new house, you've been sitting under one. On the one hand, that's all right. By building things so cheaply and lightly, we use fewer of the world's resources. On the other hand, the massive trees that yielded the great wooden posts and beams that still support medieval European, Japanese, and early American walls are now too precious and rare, and we're left to make do with gluing together smaller boards and scraps. The resin in your cost-conscious choice of a wood chip roof, a waterproof goo of formaldehyde and phenol polymer, was also applied along the board's exposed edges, but it fails anyway because moisture enters around the nails. Soon they're rusting, and their grip begins to loosen. That presently leads not only to interior leaks, but to structural mayhem. Besides underlying the roofing, the wooden sheathing secures trusses to each other. The trusses, pre-manufactured braces held together with metal connection plates, are there to keep the roof from splaying. But when the sheathing goes, structural integrity goes with it. As gravity increases tension on the trusses, the quarter-inch pins securing their now rusting connector plates pull free from the wet wood, which now sports a fuzzy coating of greenish mold. Beneath the mold, thread-like filaments called hyphae are secreting enzymes that break cellulose and lignin down into fungi food. The same thing is happening to the floors inside. When the heat went off, pipes burst if you lived where it freezes, and rain is blowing in where windows have cracked from bird collisions and the stress of sagging walls. Even where the glass is still intact, rain and snow mysteriously, inexorably work their way under sills. As the wood continues to rot, trusses start to collapse against each other. Eventually, the walls lean to one side, and finally, the roof falls in. That barn roof with the 18-by-18-inch hole was likely gone inside of 10 years. Your house's lasts maybe 50 years, 100 tops. While all that disaster was unfolding, squirrels, raccoons, and lizards have been inside, chewing nest holes in the drywall, even as woodpeckers rammed their way through from the other direction. If they were initially thwarted by allegedly indestructible siding made of aluminum, vinyl, or the maintenance-free Portland cement cellulose fiber clapboards known as hardy planks, they merely have to wait a century before most of it is lying on the ground. Its factory-impregnated color is nearly gone, and as water works its inevitable way into saw cuts and holes where the planks took nails, bacteria are picking over its vegetable matter and leaving its minerals behind. Fallen vinyl siding, whose color began to fade early, is now brittle and cracking as its plasticizers degenerate. The aluminum is in better shape, but salts in water pooling on its surface slowly eat little pits that leave a grainy white coating. For many decades, even after being exposed to the elements, zinc galvanizing has protected your steel heating and cooling ducts. But water and air have been conspiring to convert it to zinc oxide. Once the coating is consumed, the unprotected thin sheet steel disintegrates in a few years. Long before that, the water-soluble gypsum in the sheetrock has washed back into the earth. That leaves the chimney, where all the trouble began. After a century, it's still standing, but its bricks have begun to drop and break as, little by little, its lime mortar, exposed to temperature swings, crumbles and powders. If you owned a swimming pool, it's now a planter box, filled with either the offspring of ornamental saplings that the developer imported, or with banished natural foliage that was still hovering on the subdivision's fringes, awaiting the chance to retake its territory. If the house's foundation involved a basement, it too is filling with soil and plant life. Brambles and wild grapevines are snaking around steel gas pipes, which will rust away before another century goes by. White plastic PVC plumbing has yellowed and thinned on the side exposed to the light, where its chloride is weathering to hydrochloric acid, dissolving itself and its polyvinyl partners. Only the bathroom tile, the chemical properties of its fired ceramic not unlike those of fossils, is relatively unchanged, although it now lies in a pile mixed with leaf litter. After 500 years, what is left depends on where in the world you lived. If the climate was temperate, a forest stands in place of a suburb. Minus a few hills, it's begun to resemble what it was before developers, or the farmers they expropriated, first saw it. Amid the trees, half concealed by a spreading understory, lie aluminum dishwasher parts and stainless steel cookware, their plastic handles splitting, but still solid. Over the coming centuries, although there will be no metallurgists around to measure it, the pace at which aluminum pits and corrodes will finally be revealed. A relatively new material, Aluminum was unknown to early humans because its ore must be electrochemically refined to form metal. The chromium alloys that give stainless steel its resilience, however, will probably continue to do so for millennia, especially if the pots, pans, and carbon-tempered cutlery are buried out of the reach of atmospheric oxygen. 100,000 years hence, the intellectual development of whatever creature digs them up might be kicked abruptly to a higher evolutionary plane by the discovery of ready-made tools. Then again, lack of knowledge of how to duplicate them could be a demoralizing frustration, or an awe-arousing mystery that ignites religious consciousness. If you were a desert dweller, the plastic components of modern life flake and peel away faster, as polymer chains crack under an ultraviolet barrage of daily sunshine. With less moisture, wood lasts longer there, though any metal in contact with salty desert soils will corrode more quickly. Still, from Roman ruins, we can guess that thick cast iron will be around well into the future's archaeological record. So the odd prospect of fire hydrants sprouting amidst cacti may someday be among the few clues that humanity was here. Although adobe and plaster walls will have eroded away, the wrought iron balconies and window grates that once adorned them may still be recognizable, albeit airy as tulle, as corrosion eating through the iron encounters its matrix of indigestible glass slag. Once we built structures entirely from the most durable substances we knew, granite block, for instance. The results are still around today to admire, but we don't often emulate them, because quarrying, cutting, transporting, and fitting stone require a patience we no longer possess. No one since the likes of Antoni Gaudí, who began Barcelona's yet unfinished Sagrada Familia Basilica in 1880, contemplates investing in construction that our great-great-grandchildren's grandchildren will complete 250 years hence. Nor, absent the availability of a few thousand slaves, is it cheap, especially compared to another Roman innovation, concrete. Today, that brew of clay, sand, and a paste made of the calcium of ancient seashells hardens into a man-made rock that is increasingly the most affordable option for Homo sapiens urbanus. What happens, then, to the cement cities now home to more than half the humans alive? Before we consider that, there's a matter to address regarding climate. If we were to vanish tomorrow, the momentum of certain forces we've already set in motion will continue until centuries of gravity, chemistry, and entropy slow them to an equilibrium that may only partly resemble the one that existed before us. That former equilibrium depended on a sizable amount of carbon locked away beneath Earth's crust, much of which we've now relocated into the atmosphere. Instead of rotting, the wood frames of houses may be preserved like the timbers of Spanish galleons wherever rising seas pickle them in salt water. In a warmer world, the deserts may grow drier, but the parts where humans dwelled will likely again be visited by what attracted those humans in the first place: flowing water. From Cairo to Phoenix, desert cities rose where rivers made arid soils livable. Then, as population grew, humans seized control of those aquatic arteries, diverting them in ways that allowed for even more growth. But after people are gone, the diversions will soon follow them. Drier, hotter desert climates will be complemented by wetter, stormier mountain weather systems that will send floods roaring downstream, overwhelming dams, spreading over their former alluvial plains, and entombing whatever was built there in annual layers of silt. Within them, fire hydrants, truck tires, shattered plate glass, condominia, and office buildings may remain indefinitely, but as far from sight as the Carboniferous formation once was. No memorial will mark their burial, though the roots of cottonwoods, willows, and palms may occasionally make note of their presence. Only eons later, when old mountains have worn away and new ones risen, will young streams cutting fresh canyons through sediments reveal what once, briefly, went on here. Chapter 3. The City Without Us. The notion that someday nature could swallow whole something so colossal and concrete as a modern city doesn't slide easily into our imaginations. The sheer titanic presence of a New York City resists efforts to picture it wasting away. The events of September 2001 showed only what human beings with explosive hardware can do, not crude processes like erosion or rot. The breathtaking swift collapse of the World Trade Center towers suggested more to us about their attackers than about mortal vulnerabilities that could doom our entire infrastructure. And even that once inconceivable calamity was confined to just a few buildings. Nevertheless, the time it would take nature to rid itself of what urbanity has wrought may be less than we might suspect. In 1939, a World's Fair was held in New York. For its exhibit, the government of Poland sent a statue of Władysław Jagiello. The founder of the Białowieska Puszcza had not been immortalized in bronze for preserving a chunk of primeval forest 6 centuries earlier. By marrying its queen, Jagiello had united Poland and his duchy of Lithuania into a European power. The sculpture portrays him on horseback, following his victory at the Battle of Grunwald in 1410. Triumphant, he hoists 2 swords captured from Poland's latest vanquished enemy, the Teutonic Knights of the Cross. In 1939, however, the Poles weren't faring so well against some descendants of those Teutonic Knights. Before the New York World's Fair ended, Hitler's Nazis had taken Poland, and the sculpture couldn't be returned to its homeland. 6 sad years later, the Polish government gave it to New York as a symbol of its courageous, battered survivors. The statue of Jagiello was placed in Central Park, overlooking what today is called Turtle Pond. When Dr. Eric Sanderson leads a tour through the park, he and his flock usually pass Jagiello without pausing, because they are lost in another century altogether, the 17th. Bespectacled under his wide-brimmed felt hat, a trim beard graying around his chin, and a laptop jammed in his backpack, Sanderson is a landscape ecologist with the Wildlife Conservation Society, a global squadron of researchers trying to save an imperiled world from itself. At its Bronx Zoo headquarters, Sanderson directs the Manhattan Project, an attempt to recreate virtually Manhattan Island as it was when Henry Hudson's crew first saw it in 1609, a pre-urban vision that tempts speculation about how a post-human future might look. His team has scoured original Dutch documents, colonial British military maps, topographic surveys, and centuries of assorted archives throughout town. They've probed sediments, analyzed fossil pollens, and plugged thousands of bits of biological data into imaging software that generates 3-dimensional panoramas of the heavily wooded wilderness on which a metropolis was juxtaposed. With each new entry of a species of grass or tree that is historically confirmed in some part of the city, the images grow more detailed, more startling, more convincing. Their goal is a block-by-city-block guide to this ghost forest, the one Eric Sanderson uncannily seems to see even while dodging Fifth Avenue buses. When Sanderson wanders through Central Park, he's able to look beyond the 500,000 cubic yards of soil hauled in by its designers, Frederick Law Olmsted and Calvert Vaux, to fill in what was mostly a swampy bog surrounded by poison oak and sumac. He can trace the shoreline of the long, narrow lake that lay along what is now 59th Street, north of the Plaza Hotel, with its tidal outlet that meandered through salt marsh to the East River. From the west, he can see a pair of streams entering the lake that drain the slope of Manhattan's major ridgeline, a deer and mountain lion trail known today as Broadway. Eric Sanderson sees water flowing everywhere in town, much of it bubbling from underground, which is how Spring Street got its name. He's identified more than 40 brooks and streams that traversed what was once a hilly, rocky island. In the Algonquin tongue of its first human occupants, the Lenni Lenape, Manna-Hata referred to those now-vanished hills. When New York's 19th-century planners imposed a grid on everything north of Greenwich Village, the jumble of original streets to the south being impossible to unsnarl, they behaved as if topography were irrelevant. Except for some massive, unmovable schist outcrops in Central Park and at the island's northern tip, Manhattan's textured terrain was squashed and dumped into stream beds, then planed and leveled to receive the advancing city. Later, new contours arose, this time routed through rectilinear forms and hard angles, much as the water that once sculpted the island's land was now forced underground through a lattice of pipes. Eric Sanderson's Manna-Hata project has plotted how closely the modern sewer system follows the old watercourses, although man-made sewer lines can't wick away runoff as efficiently as nature. In a city that buried its rivers, he observes, rain still falls. It has to go somewhere. As it happens, that will be the key to breaching Manhattan's hard shell if nature sets about dismantling it. It would begin very quickly, with the first strike at the city's most vulnerable spot, its underbelly. New York City Transit's Paul Schuber and Peter Briffa, superintendent of hydraulics and Level 1 maintenance supervisor of hydraulics emergency response, respectively, understand perfectly how this would work. Every day, they must keep 13 million gallons of water from overpowering New York's subway tunnels. That's just the water that's already underground, notes Schuber. When it rains, the amount is... Briffa shows his palms, surrendering. It's incalculable. Maybe not actually incalculable, but it doesn't rain any less now than before the city was built. Once, Manhattan was 27 square miles of porous ground, interlaced with living roots that siphoned the 47.2 inches of average annual rainfall up trees and into meadow grasses, which drank their fill and exhaled the rest back into the atmosphere. Whatever the roots didn't take settled into the island's water table. In places, it surfaced in lakes and marshes, with the excess draining off to the ocean via those 40 streams, which now lie trapped beneath concrete and asphalt. Today, because there's little soil to absorb rainfall or vegetation to transpire it, and because buildings block sunlight from evaporating it, rain collects in puddles or follows gravity down sewers. Or it flows into subway vents, adding to the water already down there. Below 131st Street and Lenox Avenue, for example, a rising underground river is corroding the bottom of the A, B, C, and D subway lines. Constantly, men in reflective vests and denim roughouts, like Schuber's and Briffa's, are clamoring around beneath the city to deal with the fact that under New York, groundwater is always rising. Whenever it rains hard, sewers clog with storm debris. The number of plastic garbage bags adrift in the world's cities may truly exceed calculation. And the water, needing to go somewhere, plops down the nearest subway stairs. Add a nor'easter, and the surging Atlantic Ocean bangs against New York's water table, until in places like Water Street in Lower Manhattan, or Yankee Stadium in the Bronx, it backs up right into the tunnels, shutting everything down until it subsides. Should the ocean continue to warm and rise even faster than the current inch per decade, at some point, it simply won't subside. Schuber and Briffa have no idea what will happen then. Add to all that the 1930s vintage water mains that frequently burst, and the only thing that has kept New York from flooding already is the incessant vigilance of its subway crews and 753 pumps. Think about those pumps. New York's subway system, an engineering marvel in 1903, was laid underneath an already existing, burgeoning city. As that city already had sewer lines, the only place for subways to go was below them. So, explains Schuber, we have to pump uphill. In this, New York is not alone. Cities like London, Moscow, and Washington built their subways far deeper, often to double as bomb shelters. Therein lies much potential disaster. Shading his eyes with his white hard hat, Schuber peers down into a square pit beneath the Van Sicklen Avenue station in Brooklyn, where each minute 650 gallons of natural groundwater gush from the bedrock. Gesturing over the roaring cascade, he indicates four submersible cast-iron pumps that take turns laboring against gravity to stay ahead. Such pumps run on electricity. When the power fails, things can get difficult very fast. Following the World Trade Center attack, an emergency pump train bearing a jumbo portable diesel generator pumped out 27 times the volume of Shea Stadium. Had the Hudson River actually burst through the PATH train tunnels that connect New York subways to New Jersey, as was greatly feared, the pump train, and possibly much of the city, would simply have been overwhelmed. In an abandoned city, there would be no one like Paul Schuber and Peter Briffa to race from station to flooded station whenever more than 2 inches of rain falls, as happens lately with disturbing frequency, sometimes snaking hoses up stairways to pump to a sewer down the street, sometimes navigating these tunnels in inflatable boats. With no people, there would also be no power. The pumps will go off and stay off. When this pump facility shuts down, says Schuber, in half an hour water reaches a level where trains can't pass anymore. Briffa removes his safety goggles and rubs his eyes. A flood in one zone would push water into the others. Within 36 hours, the whole thing could fill. Even if it weren't raining, with subway pumps stilled, that would take no more than a couple of days, they estimate. At that point, water would start sluicing away soil under the pavement. Before long, streets start to crater. With no one unclogging sewers, some new watercourses form on the surface. Others appear suddenly as waterlogged subway ceilings collapse. Within 20 years, the water-soaked steel columns that support the street above the East Side's 4, 5, and 6 trains corrode and buckle. As Lexington Avenue caves in, it becomes a river. Well before then, however, pavement all over town would have already been in trouble. According to Dr. Jamil Ahmad, chairman of the Civil Engineering Department at New York's Cooper Union, things will begin to fall apart during the first month of March, after humans vacate Manhattan. Each March, temperatures normally flutter back and forth around 32 degrees Fahrenheit as many as 40 times. Presumably, climate change could push this back to February. Whenever it is, the repeated freezing and thawing make asphalt and cement split. When snow thaws, water seeps into these fresh cracks. When it freezes, the water expands, and cracks widen. Call it water's retaliation for being squished under all that cityscape. Almost every other compound in nature contracts when frozen, but H2O molecules do the opposite, organizing themselves into elegant hexagonal crystals that take up about 9% more space than they did when sloshing around in a liquid state. Pretty six-sided crystals suggest snowflakes so gossamer, it's hard to conceive of them pushing apart slabs of sidewalk. It's even more difficult to imagine carbon steel water pipes built to withstand 7,500 pounds of pressure per square inch, exploding when they freeze. Yet, that's exactly what happens. As pavement separates, weeds like mustard, shamrock, and goosegrass blow in from Central Park and work their way down the new cracks, which widen further. In the current world, before they get too far, city maintenance usually shows up, kills the weeds, and fills the fissures. But in the post-people world, there's no one left to continually patch New York. The weeds are followed by the city's most prolific exotic species, the Chinese ailanthus tree. Even with 8 million people around, ailanthus, otherwise innocently known as the tree of heaven, are implacable invaders capable of rooting in tiny chinks in subway tunnels, unnoticed until their spreading leaf canopies start poking from sidewalk grates. With no one to yank their seedlings, within 5 years, powerful ailanthus roots are heaving up sidewalks and wreaking havoc in sewers, which are already stressed by all the plastic bags and old newspaper mush that no one is clearing away. As soil long trapped beneath pavement gets exposed to sun and rain, other species jump in, and soon leaf litter adds to the rising piles of debris clogging the sewer grates. The early pioneer plants won't even have to wait for the pavement to fall apart. Starting from the mulch collecting in gutters, a layer of soil will start forming atop New York's sterile hard shell, and seedlings will sprout. With far less organic material available to it, just wind-blown dust and urban soot, precisely that has happened in an abandoned elevated iron bed of the New York Central Railroad on Manhattan's west side. Since trains stopped running there in 1980, the inevitable ailanthus trees have been joined by a thickening ground cover of onion grass and fuzzy lamb's ear, accented by stands of goldenrod. In some places, the track emerges from the second stories of warehouses it once serviced into elevated lanes of wild crocuses, irises, evening primrose, asters, and Queen Anne's lace. So many New Yorkers, glancing down from windows in Chelsea's art district, were moved by the sight of this untended flowering green ribbon, prophetically and swiftly laying claim to a dead slice of their city, that it was dubbed the High Line and officially designated a park. In the first few years with no heat, pipes burst all over town, the freeze-thaw cycle moves indoors, and things start to seriously deteriorate. Buildings groan as their innards expand and contract. Joints between walls and rooflines separate. Where they do, rain leaks in, bolts rust, and facing pops off, exposing insulation. If the city hasn't burned yet, it will now. Collectively, New York architecture isn't as combustible as, say, San Francisco's incendiary rows of clabbered Victorians. But with no firemen to answer the call, a dry lightning strike that ignites a decade of dead branches and leaves piling up in Central Park will spread flames through the streets. Within 2 decades, lightning rods have begun to rust and snap, and roof fires leap among buildings, entering paneled offices filled with paper fuel. Gas lines ignite with a rush of flames that blows out windows. Rain and snow blow in. And soon even poured concrete floors are freezing, thawing, and starting to buckle. Burnt insulation and charred wood add nutrients to Manhattan's growing soil cap. Native Virginia creeper and poison ivy claw at walls covered with lichens, which thrive in the absence of air pollution. Red-tailed hawks and peregrine falcons nest in increasingly skeletal high-rise structures. Within 2 centuries, estimates Brooklyn Botanical Garden Vice President Stephen Clements, colonizing trees will have substantially replaced pioneer weeds. Gutters buried under tons of leaf litter provide new fertile ground for native oaks and maples from city parks. Arriving black locust and autumn olive shrubs fix nitrogen, allowing sunflowers, bluestem, and white snake root to move in along with apple trees, their seeds expelled by proliferating birds. Biodiversity will increase even more, predicts Cooper Union Civil Engineer Chair Jamil Ahmad, as buildings tumble and smash into each other, and lime from crushed concrete raises soil pH, inviting in trees, such as buckthorn and birch, that need less acidic environments. Ahmad, a hearty silver-haired man whose hands talk in descriptive circles, believes that process will begin faster than people might think. A native of Lahore, Pakistan, a city of ancient mosaic-encrusted mosques, he now teaches how to design and retrofit buildings to withstand terrorist attacks, and has accrued a keen understanding of structural weakness. Even buildings anchored into hard Manhattan schist, like most New York skyscrapers, he notes, weren't intended to have their steel foundations waterlogged. plugged sewers, deluge tunnels, and streets reverting to rivers, he says, will conspire to undermine sub-basements and destabilize their huge loads. In a future that portends stronger and more frequent hurricanes striking North America's Atlantic coast, ferocious winds will pummel tall, unsteady structures. Some will topple, knocking down others. Like a gap in the forest,